Thank you, Barbara, and I'd also like to thank the Fields Institute for hosting me and the Clay Mathematics Institute for the fellowship on which this talk is based. I should warn you that that fellowship was not selected on the basis of any pedagogical ability, but I'll do my best to make it worth your while. And if not that, at least it's worth the price of admission. So what I want to talk about today is an emerging relationship between the fields of physics and mathematics, in which the two fields seem to have a real interdependence. Physics and mathematics have always coexisted happily, but lately the relationship has become much stronger. And that's what I am trying to connote with the word physmatics. I'll try to describe that relationship and give you a hands-on example of how it works in as non-technical terms as possible. So to set the stage, I want to give a few selected quotations through the years involving mathematics and physics and the way they interact. Over 2,000 years ago, much more than 2,000 years ago, Aristotle in ancient Greece had this to say. The so-called Pythagoreans, who were the first to take up mathematics, not only advanced the subject, but saturated with it, they fancied that the principles of mathematics were the principles of all things. So they already recognize a deep relationship between mathematics and things, physics. In fact, the Pythagoreans weren't even the first, but as far as he knew, they were. And mathematics and physics continued happily for more than two millennia until in 1972, the notable physicist Freeman Dyson had this to say. I'm acutely aware that the marriage between mathematics and physics, which was so enormously fruitful in the past centuries, has recently ended in divorce. So the situation was bleak only a few years ago. And this recent interdependence among the fields is a reconciliation of that divorce, which was seen in 2001 through the quotation of string theorist's greatest proponent, perhaps, Edward Witten. If you went back to the 19th century or earlier, mathematicians and physicists tended to be the same people. But in the 20th century, mathematics became much more broader and in many ways much more abstract. What has happened in the last 20 years or so is that some areas of mathematics that seemed to be so abstract that they were no longer connected with physics instead turn out to be related to the new quantum physics. The quantum gauge theories, and especially the supersymmetric theories and string theories that physicists are developing now. So Witten is describing a much happier relationship between the two fields. And so in the next few moments, I want to describe what happened to lead to the divorce, and before the divorce, and what is happening today. Well, what happened is basically that the two fields grew up side by side, but as they matured in different directions. In relationship terms, you know, the spouses grew apart. And that just happened because the two fields pursued their own interests. What seems to be happening in physmatics is that the relationship is so intertwined between the two fields that it appears to be unlikely that they will grow apart. That remains to be seen, of course, but I think it's something new. So what I'll do here today is review some concepts in physics and mathematics, ingredients that we'll need to really understand physmatics in our example. And as I do so, I'll show how these disciplines relate. I'll then use these concepts to explain duality, which is perhaps the best example of physmatics. It's not a typo. When I wrote this talk, it was raining, and I considered, how would we understand the rain? You might try understanding it in two processes. The droplets form, and then they fall. Or maybe they form as they fall. But there are two different aspects to rain. It's immediately seen to be a formidable problem because there are zillions of droplets, each with millions of, or in zillions or jillions of molecules. And it's way too much to consider. You could try writing them down and it would take you the age of the universe just to enumerate all the molecules. Instead, what you could try to do is to estimate the likelihood of a particular event happening, a particular type of formation of droplet, a big one, a small one, a medium one, and then make predictions about what's most likely to happen on average. And since there are so many molecules and droplets out there, you may be fruitful in making average kinds of predictions by the so-called law of large numbers. And in fact, that's what these physicists did. I'm not going to discuss their work, just to show you that you can consider the problem of droplet formation with some rigor. And if you have good eyes, you'll see that there's a statistical model invoked. I'm not going to even let you read any more than that. So let's make things a little bit simpler and just speak about the descent, the fall to Earth. To describe the fall to Earth, the least you would say is that the droplet picks up speed as it descends to Earth. You're hit by rain. And to describe speed, well, you need some notion of distance, some way of measuring distance. Maybe it goes from height 4 to height 3, and that would correspond to distance 1 in some units. And some way of measuring time, and divide the distance by the time, and you get some rate of speed. So we're almost forced, if we want a quantitative description, to use mathematics. In this case, what Newton did is in describing the droplets, or apple droplets, is he used these notions of length and time, or more generally, geometry, to describe the fall of raindrops or apples. And he did that with coordinates. Now, we probably know that Newton's story was not the last story about gravity. Einstein realized that the coordinates that we used in Newtonian gravity weren't necessarily the best ones. In fact, if we were hurtling through space, we might have different notions of length and different notions of time. And that was the only way that Einstein could reconcile the constancy of the speed of light, by changing the notion of length and time and realizing that our coordinates don't so naturally relate to the notions of distance and time. Length and time are not universal, Einstein realized. Or I should let him say it and not me. I won't read it out loud because Einstein and I have somewhat different sensibilities, but I think his explanation is, well, Einsteinian. So length and time are not universal. We need a way of formulating the laws of physics which don't depend on our description, our coordinates, carrying the most natural notions of length and time. To exhibit how the Newtonian description is dependent on coordinates, you can go to different coordinates and see how it might change. Newton's laws are not obeyed in different coordinates, and therefore Newton's description depends on the coordinates. So I'll just do this briefly. The first view will be of a ball rolling back and forth on a merry-go-round, and it rolls straight from the point of view of the stationary camera. But from the point of view of spinning coordinates, or the spinning camera, you'll see that the ball does not obey Newton's laws, and suddenly it has a force applied to it. There it's going straight. But in spinning coordinates, Newton's law is not obeyed. There's some force that comes out of nowhere. So Einstein's improvement of that is independent of which coordinates you use, and that uses the mathematical language of differential geometry, and it's very closely tied to it. So that's a good example of how mathematics is almost inevitable, and even sophisticated mathematics, once you start to really understand even seemingly simple questions. Now, that physics was classical. I now turn to some quantum type of physics. If I took a prism and put it in that window, you'd see the light coming in and being dispersed by the prism into its different colors or constituent frequencies. But it turns out that if you do the same thing with so-called pure light, you get a different phenomenon. There's not this continuous spectrum that you see over here, but rather just certain frequencies. The explanation of all that involves quantum mechanics, which is a big story that I won't review everything of. I'm just going to select a piece of quantum mechanics that we'll need to understand our example of schismatics. So let's review what the explanation of this phenomenon was like. Well, there are basically four steps. First step, there are atoms that have nuclei and electrons around them. We might realize that. Second, according to the Bohr model, electrons orbit the nucleus in an atom in discrete energy bands. Not every energy is possible, but only certain discrete energy bands. That model is actually borne out by the rigorous formulation through equations, the Schrodinger equation, which is a very good example of the application of differential equations to physics, though I won't discuss that equation. So we have these discrete energy levels, and the electrons can jump from one to the other, and the difference in energy is emitted as light. Because these energy levels are discrete, not every one is possible, then the differences in energies are also discrete, and therefore the different energies of the light or the different frequencies of the light are not in a continuum but in discrete bands. And that's how the explanation goes. And then we note that if there are enough molecules producing the light, then there are so many bands and so many differences in the energies of bands that it looks as if every frequency is represented and we have a continuum. Although actually if you look more closely, you'll find that it's not a continuum. Actually, Newton and Hooke famously clashed about light and whether or not it was a particle or a wave. And it turns out that in the final description, more than 200 years later, they were both right in some sense. I think Pink Floyd was the first to observe this phenomenon. Okay, so let me talk a little bit more precisely, but not very much, about the quantization of momentum. If we have a particle moving around in a circle, the wave description of that particle is as a standing wave. So here I've sort of drawn the wave on moving around the circle. And if it's a standing wave, it has to come back to itself around the circle. So its wavelength, the length between crests, must divide the circumference 2 pi r of the circle. So only certain wavelengths are allowed. This is de Broglie's model. Certain wavelengths are allowed, the circumference divided by an integer. Well, that model has consequences. It turns out that momentum is inversely proportional to wavelength. So if the wavelength looks like is proportional to the radius of the circle divided by an integer, then the momentum is proportional to the integer divided by the radius of the circle. I won't worry about the constants of proportionality. So for all intents and purposes, we'll just need to remember that a particle on a circle of radius r has momentum quantized by this integer n in units of 1 over r. And again, if r is very large, these momenta are quantized in terms of very small increments, and it looks like every value could be achieved. And then we recover a classical description. Okay, so actually, this is what we need to remember. Momentum is n over r, where n is an integer. Okay, proceeding with other areas of physics and their relation to mathematics, we'll study electricity and magnetism, but more precisely, the symmetries of electricity and magnetism. So if I wanted to study this piece of chalk, it has a symmetry. I can rotate it. So whatever equations I need to solve regarding the physics of this piece of chalk, throwing something at it or whatnot, those equations will have some solutions. And after I rotate the chalk, those equations will still be solutions. And so the rotation is a physical symmetry here, and it's borne out in the mathematics as a symmetry of the equations. Well, the symmetry of electricity and magnetism is similar, only we're allowed a rotation by an arbitrary angle, not just for a particular angle, but at every point in space and time. And these are the symmetries of the equations of electricity and magnetism formulated by James Clerk Maxwell, seen here on some Scottish moor. Actually, there's an amazing apartment building in Brazil called the Suite Vollard building. And it's such that at every floor, or every height, you can rotate the floor. You can rotate the apartment, sort of like a revolving restaurant, but you can do it at every height. Of course, that rotation doesn't change anything. It's still the same old building. So that rotation, here in this example, we have a much richer symmetry, namely rotations at every height. But in the theory of electromagnetism, we have an even richer symmetry, rotations at every point in space and time. That symmetry is called gauge symmetry. And the way it works is you have the electricity, the electric and the magnetic fields described through this combined potential, A. And using an angle F, or a function, which defines an angle at every point in space and time, you can change the potential which encodes the electric and magnetic fields. But it turns out that you change it in such a way that the electric and magnetic fields themselves are remained unchanged. Then, since the equations involve this A, it turns out that the equations, that this change is also a symmetry of those equations. The way it works, the way you can sort of get a feel for how it might work, is if you were interested in the quotient of two numbers, B and A, B divided by A, that quotient would remain unchanged if I take B and replace it by B times F, and I take A and replace it by A times F. That leaves the quotient the same. Well, a more sophisticated version of that leaves the electric field E and the magnetic field B invariant after you make this change. It's a very rich symmetry, and it's called gauge symmetry. And now I want to talk about the mathematics, which is related to this physics. And the mathematics is differential geometry. So let's consider a space here, sigma, a sphere. At every point in the space, P, we can think of its tangent space, this red plane. And the collection of all tangent planes forms what's known as the tangent bundle, T sigma. So that a point in the tangent bundle is a point of the space, namely that point whose tangent plane we're considering, together with some vector V in that tangent plane. So you can think of it as a point on the space together with some velocity vector, say, V. And that's called the tangent plane. Or if we consider not velocities, but just the directions of velocities, then at each point of our space, we get a circle of possible directions, seen here, that circle. That's called, instead of a tangent bundle, it's called the circle bundle. At every point, you have a circle, just like that Suite Vollard building. Now, here's the catch. Whereas zero velocity makes sense, zero direction does not make sense. So constructions involving circles have the great freedom of starting each of the circles from an arbitrary point. And that was precisely the freedom of gauge symmetry. So circle bundles really capture the freedom of electricity and magnetism. And these are a nice mathematical construction which describes the physical symmetries of electricity and magnetism. So you see here that mathematics and physics are closely tied. They always have been. I'm not trying to deny that. Now it'll become useful for us to consider types of objects. So let me look at what are objects in physics. Well, physics has many types of objects. For example, a theory of gravity has objects such as black holes. Here's a description of a black hole, singularity in red, maybe an event horizon in green. A theory of magnetism or electricity and magnetism has particles with charge, like electric charge, and you can consider particles that have magnetic charge, magnetic monopoles. You probably won't find them in this room, because we've all been taught that magnets have a positive a north pole and a south pole, two poles. But you can imagine magnets with just one pole, and those are called monopoles. And they should have a description in your physics, even if they don't exist in reality. And there are other types of objects, which I'll call solitons. Here's a theory with two vacua, where we can sit here at minimum energy, or we can sit here at minimum energy. Namely, the value of phi here could live here or live there. And there are types of particles which interpolate between those two vacua, here and here. Namely, if phi at negative infinity achieves this value, and phi at positive infinity achieves that value. So all these kinds of particles might exist in your physical theory. But if you have a theory which is supposed to unify all the forces, then that theory should have a description of all these kinds of particles. And that's where we come to string theory. String theory is an attempt at a unification of all the forces in physics. So string theory should have a description of all these kinds of particles. Whether or not the predictions of string theory are correct, it should be able to describe these kinds of particles, and indeed it does. And they can all be described in a unified framework that we'll call brains. I'll come back to brains later. So these are some of the objects that you might meet in your physics, and they have a unified description in a unified theory. Okay. Let's move on to some differential topology, a branch of mathematics, which will also give us another way of encoding something like momentum. Momentum had to do with a particle in a circle, but something somewhat different. Namely, momentum was quantized due to some quantum phenomenon, but the charge that we're going to talk about now is quantized for purely classical reasons. So let's consider a closed loop of string on a circle. The string is in green, the circle is in R. And the string can wrap m times around the circle, where m must be an integer. So that if I had a rubber band, I could wrap it around my finger an integer number of times. And if I take the smallest such string which does that, its length would be proportional to m times the circumference of the circle, since it wrapped m times. So that's the first and easiest example of a quantized charge, the winding of a string. And it's quantized not for any quantum mechanics, but purely classical reasons. This will become important for us, so I've written it down there. There are other types of charge which are also quantized for classical reasons. For example, look at this object, a kind of bagel with three holes. You can immediately see that it has three holes. But if you were a computer, you might not immediately see that. How would we tell a computer to make a calculation and get the answer 3? We can't tell it, just look. You have to tell it a little bit more. And Gauss and Bonnet, the theorem of Gauss and Bonnet does precisely just that. Namely, you take the curvature at some point where it's more curved, like in the middle here, the curvature would be higher. Where it's less curved, the curvature would be lower. You take that curvature and you integrate it over the manifold, or you sum it up over all points. And you look at the answer you get. According to the theorem, the answer is always an integer, no matter how you change the shape of the object. So if you squish that bagel a little bit or stretch it a little bit, if it was some chew toy, you'd still get the same answer. And if there are three holes, your answer would be 2 minus 2 times 3, which is 2 minus 6, or negative 4. So that's a remarkable way of using local information, differential information, to get one of these integers which characterizes the surface. If you move the surface a little bit, you get the same integer. In fact, there are generalizations of this theorem that apply not to just spaces, but also to bundles, like the bundles that we met back here, the circle bundles or the tangent bundles. There are integers which characterize not the specifics, but the global information encoded in the topology of those bundles. Actually, one of the great achievements of 20th century was the theorem of Atiyah, Patadi, and Singer, which interprets these integers in yet another way, as the number of solutions to differential equations. And we'll come back to that as well. Okay, so we can take a break. That was all the ingredients that we'll need to describe schismatics for our example. And so let's review them. In describing physics to this stage, researchers develop the relevant mathematics along the way. So if their physics was Newtonian physics, we saw that the mathematics involved was geometry and calculus of speeds and accelerations. Einstein's improvement gave a coordinate-free description of gravity, where our coordinates didn't have to represent time and space so obviously. And the mathematics which enabled him to do that actually pre-existed his theories, and it's called differential geometry. So sometimes physics scoops math, sometimes math scoops physics. But in schismatics, it's almost impossible to separate one from the other. In the quantum theory, we needed to analyze the wave functions, and that's the analysis of functions, and their the solutions of differential equations, and representation theory, which I haven't discussed. And for the gauge theories, we saw that we had to understand the geometry and topology of bundles. So the topology of bundles encoded certain information in the bundle, which is also encoded in that electromagnetic potential A. So there's in that electromagnetic potential A, or the electric and magnetic fields, there is information not only about, there's geometric information, local information, and global information characterized by the topology. So those are some examples of the physics and math. But after this, and after all these theories were built together, physics and math grew apart. Physics became more interested in the unification of the strong and weak nuclear forces with electromagnetism, and the development of the standard model of particle physics. And mathematics became interested in other abstract areas, algebraic geometry, logic, other aspects of topology. And these two branches, these pure physics and pure math, didn't seem to be so closely related, and this is what led to Dyson's divorce. Plus, we need this extra information, which I made us remember, the momentum quantized in units of 1 over r, the length of an m-winding string being m times r, and the objects as brains. So we just needed to pick up those crumbs along the way, because we'll need them. So that's where we are so far. And we come to schismatics. Schismatics is a reconciliation of this divorce, where the spouses have now an interdependent relationship, not just a coexistence. String theory has led to and has been influenced by new mathematics, and this makes it an ideal ground to study schismatics. And the best example that I can think of comes from string theory, and it's a duality symmetry. It's known as a duality symmetry, which is when two different physical theories give exactly the same prediction. Well, in physics, all we can do is make predictions. So if two theories give the same predictions, we might as well say they're the same. Now mathematics comes along. Mathematics is the study of when two things are the same. Mathematics is, when does A equal B? Something on the left-hand side of the equation that you don't recognize, it's too hard to compute, the equation comes along and tells you it's the same as the right-hand side, and that you know. So mathematics should help us with understanding the duality of physics. And it turns out that mathematics is both new and novel. So we turn to duality, and we'll work our way up through some simple examples. So duality in TV. I hope that most in the audience are familiar with the two TV shows, The Honeymooners and The Flintstones. Do we have a raise? That might not be good. Well, The Honeymooners involves four characters, two married couples, Ralph and his wife Alice, and their neighbor Norton and his wife Trixie. The Flintstones, pictured on the right, is an animated series, but still, it involved two married couples, Fred and his wife Wilma, and Barney and his neighbor Trixie. Barney and his wife Betty. What makes the duality between these two shows is not that they both have four characters, and that I can say this character corresponds to that character, and so on, but that the relationships between the characters are the same. So that there's not just an equivalence of the objects of the show, the characters of the two TV shows, but that the way that those objects or characters relate to each other also has an equivalence. For example, if I took Seinfeld and I put it up here, it wouldn't work. George, I could write an equivalence, George, Jerry, Elaine, Kramer. Maybe that equivalence wouldn't respect the gender, but still I could make a one-to-one correspondence. But would it preserve the relationships? Let's see. In The Honeymooners, Ralph, the blustery character, and he badgers Alice all the time, but with good-natured bluster. And Alice tolerates him. Does more than that, but she, among other things, tolerates him. Now, if there's a duality symmetry, I should be able to replace all these objects in this relationship by their corresponding object in the dual TV show. So Ralph corresponds to Fred, Alice, Wilma. And it's indeed true that Fred badgers Wilma with good-natured bluster, and Wilma tolerates Fred. So there's a duality symmetry, and it's fun to look for other examples. Anyone have an example in mind? I'll give you one half. Murphy Brown. Maybe it's too old. That's almost exactly parallel to Mary Tyler Moore. Okay, moving up, raising the bar a little bit, we'll look at duality in arithmetic. This equation says times equals plus. This is a funny kind of equation. But in fact, it's true. These two operations have a duality. If I take two numbers, 10 squared, and multiply it by 10 cubed, what would you do? You add the exponents. So instead of looking at those numbers and doing it longhand, you just add the exponents. So this statement is dual to 2 plus 3 equals 5. You get the result 5, and then you take 10 to that power. And you can take any multiplication problem, and if you're old enough to remember slide rules, this may even be the way you did hard multiplication. You take two numbers, A and B. You look up their logarithms, which is easy to do in a table. You add them, which is easy to do. And then you use the same table to look up what number had that sum as its logarithm. And the answer is A times B, which was too hard to do. So multiplication and addition are actually the same. So we come now to our example, duality in physics. And we'll come back to that string and a circle, using the pieces that we collected along the way. We found that a string and a circle can wind around some integer number of times, m, And also its momentum, which was classically a continuous quantity, is quantized in terms of an integer, n. So we can describe it as such a string by a pair of integers, m, n. And an m, n string on a circle of radius r turns out to have energy equal to its length squared plus its momentum squared. So it's n over r, that was the momentum squared, plus mr was the length of an m-winding string. And the energy is the sum of those two things. Now I make the trivial observation that n divided by r is the same as n times 1 over r. Okay, that's easy. This one's a little bit harder. M times r is the same as m divided by 1 over r. So this quantity on the left is the same as m divided by 1 over r squared plus n times 1 over r squared. And we easily recognize that as the energy of an nm string, namely winding n, momentum m string, on a circle of radius 1 over r, the winding times the radius 1 over r. So in fact, the energies of these states lead you to maybe make the bold conjecture that big and small are equivalent. Namely, the physics of a circle of radius r, r might be very big, turns out to be equivalent to the physics of a circle of radius 1 over r, which might be very small. Big and small are equivalent. Now, that's a bold prediction. It's borne out in this formula, and it's up to us to investigate the consequences of that prediction or of that conjecture. So if the two string theories involving a big circle and a small circle, let's call them A and B, or if any two string theories, A and B, are dual, that means that every object of one theory has to have a dual or mirror object on the other, in the other theory. Remember, we discussed some of the objects in physics. And not only that, but the relationships between the objects have to be the same as well. And it's really in those relationships where the physics comes. Every physical calculation is some aspect of the relationship of objects. And so every calculation of A has to have an equal mirror calculation in the mirror theory B. And now we have a conjectural description of two theories, one with radius r, one with radius 1 over r. So what are we going to do? We're going to identify the objects in both theories, try to make a correspondence among them, like Fred to Ralph, and so on, and then check that the relationships also correspond. Okay? So what are the two theories? Well, instead of a circle, I'm going to consider two circles, a bagel. A bagel is the product of two circles, or the surface of a bagel, because a point isn't described by one angle or around one circle, but two angles. So if you give me an angle around this circle, let's say there, and then an angle around the other circle, there, you'll specify a unique point. So we can think of the bagel as the product of two circles. And I can take a circle, two circles, I can take the two circles to have radius r1 and r2. Now, we'll make the conjecture that in string theory, an equivalent bagel or an equivalent, or a bagel which describes an equivalent theory would be the product of circles of radii. Instead of r1, I'll take 1 over r1 and r2. Of course, I could have taken 1 over R2 as well, but let's just do 1. And in fact, this turns out to be an equivalence in string theory, as I'm going to demonstrate, or one aspect of which I'll demonstrate. It's a nice example, and it's non-trivial, but there are even much richer examples where the dual theories aren't just two bagels of different sizes, but they're actually pairs of spaces which differ in topology. Namely, the integers that we would get would be different. pairs of spaces which differ in topology that describe the same physics, as well as size, namely spaces as different as Bagel and Bialy. Well, none of the jokes have been drawing a laugh, so I don't know if you understand Bialy or not. A Bialy is a flat bagel, it doesn't have a hole. Okay? So space is as different as something with one hole, something with zero holes. Okay. Now what we want to do is take this very interesting physical observation and reap the mathematical harvest. In fact, the reaping... I'll explain. We want to reap the mathematical harvest that bagels of different sizes might lead to the same physics. First thing we need to do is identify the different objects in the two theories. Then we'll make a correspondence. The objects, as I've discussed previously, are all brains. Brains, in the theories that I'm talking about, come in two different types, C and S, which stand for mathematical words, which I don't need to describe. If you like them, you can read them. But there are two types of brains, in fact, C and S. But what are brains in the first place? The brains are locations where our strings, which previously I didn't allow to end, because they wound around, they closed with, they're now allowed to end, but they end on the brain. In fact, there could be charge there as well. So the brains are allowed to end on these special locations. The strings are allowed to end on these special locations, and those are the brains. Here's a C brain there, this plane there. Here's an S brain, this red one here. And the strings are in blue, and you can see that they end on the different brains. They might go from one brain to itself or a brain to another brain and so on. Actually, this charge we know is associated to some kind of circle bundle. So that will be relevant as well. Now, under the equivalence of theories, it turns out the types of brains are switched. So a C brain in one theory, namely, let's say the bagel A, must equal or correspond to an S brain in the other theory, B. So we need to identify that correspondence. Then, once we identify the correspondence of objects, we check the relationships. And that's how it works. And if the relationships correspond, we say we have a duality. So what are the mathematical description of C brains? In fact, this mathematical description preexisted the physics of brains and was crucial to the precise formulation of mirror symmetry. So although I've told it like a story that comes explicitly from through the physics, there's more mathematics involved in its development than I've told. Anyway, the mathematical description of C brains, which is a type of object, are as even-dimensional spaces. So here our bagel is two-dimensional. So the even-dimensional spaces could be two-dimensional and fill up the whole bagel, or they could be zero-dimensional and just be points. Let's consider the two-dimensional brains that fill the whole space. Those are described as bundles, just like the tangent bundle that we saw. And we know that bundles now, according to the theorem of Gauss and Bonnet, or its generalization, are in turn described by integers. So the C brains can be labeled with the same integers that label bundles. We only met one bundle, who's the tangent bundle. And that is one obvious integer, which is the dimension of the fiber at a point. In the tangent bundle, the fiber is this plane and has dimension 2. But I could have more general bundles, where the dimension of the fiber is different. So we call that dimension R. And there's another integer, which is sort of a characterization like the number of holes, but characterizes the bundle, called the degree, D. And that really characterizes how the fiber twists around over your surface, or the twistiness of your bundle. And it can be computed through the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. So we learn that C brains on a bagel are described by a pair of integers, R and D. So we have the objects on this bagel here, and given a pair of integers, R, D, I can construct an object. Now let's describe the objects on the other side, S brains. Well, if C brains were even dimensional, S brains are odd dimensional. The S brains are minimal subspaces of dimension D over 2. In this case, D equals 2 here, so 2 over 2 is 1. And we have minimal one-dimensional subspaces on our bagel. So it's convenient to form the bagel in two stages. First, I start out with a square piece of paper. And then I glue the two ends. Need some contrast here. I glue the two ends together, and I get a cylinder. That's this first stage. Then if you glue the two ends of the cylinder together, you get a closed tube, or the bagel. So let's consider this as the bagel, with the two ends glued together. Then the minimal subspaces are just straight lines. And a straight line is determined by its slope. Which is actually given by a pair of integers. So here I've drawn the line 2, 1. It goes up this way with slope 1 over 2, 1 half. And then when it gets to the end, I have to remember that the end is glued back over here, so it continues up. And it actually forms a kind of barbershop ball. Like that. So there's that line. And for every pair of integers, I can build such a straight line. So S brains on the dual bagel are also described by integers R, D. So right away we've just now described a correspondence among the objects. Why integers? Because if the slope was not a rational number, this line would never end. It would never close up on itself. I can't draw it on this bagel, but it wraps twice around one way as it wraps once around the other way. So there's our correspondence of objects. Now we need to check the relationships, and we're going to do that in two ways. First, we've shown a correspondence among the objects, a C brain bundle, R, D, on one bagel, R, D being the integers describing the bundle, corresponds to an S-brain line, R, D, on the mirror. Now we show the relationships correspond. Now a famous extension of the Gauss-Bonnet theorem calculates the degree between two bundles, R, D, and R prime, D prime, as R, D prime minus D, R prime. What is this integer? It actually counts the strings that sit between two brains. So what happens is, one measure of the relationship of two brains is to count how many strings go from one of the brains to another. In our example here, the brains filled up the whole space. So the strings, or more precisely, the minimal strings between them, are points, are any actually open string. This end ends on the space, and that end ends on the space. But the minimal strings are actually just points. They have no length, and they have the minimum energy. Actually, they're just standing still, because we don't want to give them any momentum either, because we want their energy to be zero. So they're just points. And to calculate them, or how many there are, you only need the quantum mechanics of points. And you find out how many solutions to the equations of quantum mechanics are there. Those are differential equations, and as I said, this theorem calculates the number of solutions of differential equations, and it gives precisely this number. So that's how you do the problem it's a little bit involved, but it's you get your answer as an integer through that theorem that we discussed. So now we want to make the dual calculation for S prime. It'll turn out to be easier, and we can actually do it. We better get the same integer. So we test the duality. Let's do the dual calculation. We want to count minimal open strings between two different brains. And I'll take a particular example, a 2-1 brain there and a 1-3 brain there. So those are my two brains, 2-1 and 1-3. Those describe two straight lines of rational slope. Here's the first one from the previous slide. We remember that one. And here's 1, 3. Notice that it wraps three times around the vertical circle. After we glue, these become circles. It wraps once, twice, three times around as it goes over once. So 1, 3. According to this prediction, the number of minimal open strings, well, now it's very easy to see what a minimal open string is. It has to be a point, but it has to go from one of the brains to the other. So it must sit at the intersection of those two brains. So we count the number of points of intersection. According to the prediction, we should get the same answer. That prediction was this formula, rd prime minus dr prime. This is r, d. This is r prime, d prime. So rd prime is 2 times 3 minus 1 times 1, which is 6 minus 1, or 5. And you'll count these points 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oops. So there seem to be 6, but now we have to remember, well, actually the top was glued down to the bottom, and the right was glued down to the left. So actually this point and that point and that point and that point are all the same. So there are only 5 different points, and it worked. So not only can we make a correspondence among the objects, but the relationships between the objects correspond under the map. And that's a test of duality. It's not the final story, but it's a very important test that needs to be obeyed. The final story comes by checking the relationships among the relationships. So for example, I can take one of these minimal open strings that sits between two brains, A and B. There's an AB open string. And take another one that sits between B and C. And we can imagine a physical process where those open strings moving. They're always remaining, their ends are always remaining on their brain. They have to remain there. But now, they combine, tip to tail. And they combine and then they keep going. And they've turned into an open string between A and C. So that an AB open string and a BC open string can form an AC string in a physical scattering process. So if this was a measure of the relationship, and that was a measure of the relationship between B and C, the process of going from AB plus BC to AC is a measure of the relationships among the relationships. And even those have to correspond. Now, according to Feynman, to study a physical process, we must understand every possible way in which the process can take place. And so we're led to a sum over all possible paths, like in blue, or in our example where the brains are straight lines, this blue path turns into a triangle between the straight lines. And we need to measure all possible triangles. So there I've drawn one obvious triangle where the A brain is a 1, 1 brain, the B brain is a 3, 1 brain, the C brain is a 1, 2. And if I sum over all possible triangles that end on those slopes whose corners lie at these lattice points, then I've summed over all possible physical processes. Mathematically, we would take the sum and weight each triangle by its area. We can calculate the area of this triangle here. Let's break it up into two triangles. This bottom one, which has area base times height over 2, or 1, and the top one, which has area base times height over 2, which is 4. So the area is 5. actually, that triangle is area 5, but if I multiply it, if I scale it up, make a bigger triangle, say twice it, it would have area 5 times 4. And I need to sum over all possible multiples of that triangle. And that would tell us the contribution to this physical process. Actually, you can do that test, and you can do all other tests of that duality between the two bagels, and you can prove conclusively that the results always match on both sides. It is a true duality, and it can be proven as a mathematical theorem. For example, in this C-brain, if we do the C-brain calculation, we get an answer which is precisely the same one, namely a sum over n. That's n is all the triangles. E to the minus 5, n squared r1, r2, was the area of that triangle. So you get the answer correct on the nose. And in fact, in making this correction, you actually require the inversion of the radius of the circle. Whereas this previous check that I made back here, this check actually was independent of the radius, so it wasn't a very strong check, but this check is much stronger. Depends on the crucial process of R1 over R duality. So there you have it. The duality is proven, and that's our example of schismatics. You can go further. There are examples which are much more different than two bagels. Like I said, as different as bagel and bialy, and prove or try to prove the mathematical theorem, which is a consequence of duality symmetry in those examples. So I've painted schismatics as a real interdependence among math and physics, an enmeshing of the two disciplines, or parts of the two disciplines. Although my example seemed to come a little bit more from the physics side, it turns out that the new mathematics is also indispensable to the advancement of aspects of string theory. So it goes both ways, and as I said, it's really enmeshed. So the ideas of physics are fundamental to pure abstract math, and this is what I call schismatics. There may be some doubters. This is what Helen Keller said about a century ago. Now, I feel as if I should succeed in doing something in mathematics, although I cannot see why it is so very important. The knowledge doesn't make my life any sweeter or happier, does it? I disagree. And in this case, a picture of Sir Michael Atiyah involved in the sweet and happy pursuit of mathematics, I feel, is worth 1,000 retorts. That's all I have to say.